Hello and welcome to the Send Parenting Balance podcast. My name is Katie Walker and I talk all things parenting children with autism, ADHD and or PDA. Today's topic is a good one. Today I want to share my knowledge of the system with you, which may help you when navigating the system because in our case, knowledge is power, right? Support for our neurodiverse children within the mainstream system at all levels is incredibly limited and in some cases non-existent. This means parents and carers of neurodiverse children are having to pick up the shortfall of society either by home educating, changing their hours of work, perhaps even leaving their careers, and of course being the coordinator of care for their child, which can be absolutely life-changing. I will dive into school systems, local authority systems, the Early Help Hub, NHS, and social working agencies, and explain at how every level, unfortunately, it can feel as if the system is set up against us, and how actually there's very little room for neurodiversity. We will also dive into how you can change your strategy to work alongside such a frustrating system to shield yourself from trauma created by the mainstream system onto you and your family, and how, in fact, we can empower ourselves moving forward. As you are aware, although I am now a full-time carer at home with my neurospicy children and also a SEND parenting advocate, I have in my past life worked within schools and local authorities within the family support systems, and so I aim to share some of my experiences of how this mainstream system is set up and how indeed it's set to fail. Before I dive into the negativities and the frustrations and the complexities of the system when it comes to supporting our neurodiverse children, I'd like to highlight that there are a lot of professionals that work within this system that are incredibly supportive and kind to neurodiverse families and are managing to support in the best ways possible. Not all families that I work alongside have had a troublesome time within the mainstream system. However, the general trend is that of parental discrimination, parental blame, lack of understanding, lack of support, misinterpretations, and of course, trauma. So let's unpick why that may be the case. Let's unpick why the system feels so overwhelmingly unfit for purpose. The structure of the system is completely unfit for purpose and is broken. The system, unfortunately, did not grow with the need for neurodiverse children, and it did not get the hint by the statistics of so many children out of education. Why has the hint not been taken? In my opinion, it's because the whole system at every level would require a complete overhaul, and the funding clearly isn't there to do it. When I speak of levels of support in the mainstream system, I'm referring to support at school level, support at NHS level, support at social care level, support at local authority level, and of course, support at Early Help Hub level. Due to these levels being unfit for purpose and how the mainstream system is currently set up, there feels like there's not a space for neurodiversity. Because each level or service working within its tight funding and policy restrictions means that needs cannot be met. So let's start by looking at the mainstream schools and why it can literally feel like you are banging your head against a brick wall over and over and over to be heard. Firstly, schools do get the worst deal, I think. Perhaps it's because they're the ones, as parents, we actually have access to on a daily basis. However, schools too are actually shouting the loudest to the government for extra support. They've been shouting really loudly for mental health practitioners to work within schools for over 10 years now, because the range of mental health needs within education is just too high for the SENCO and teaching staff alone to manage. Head teachers and teaching staff, if they were honest, would be the first ones to explain that actually they cannot manage the level of needs coming through the mainstream schools. And the government keeps putting stuff onto schools without the schools in agreeance. For example, breakfast clubs in order to get parents back to work. Schools don't want it either. It's another thing that they have to manage without extra staff or adequate funding. Have you seen the turnover of staff within mainstream schools? To be fair, that on its own kind of says it all. What a great solution would be is if parents and schools teamed together, because we actually want the same things in a roundabout way: more funding, more staff, more support. but I'm yet to find a school that speaks openly and honestly about the behind-the-scenes struggles and complexities, teaming with parents with a shared empathy and understanding that the system is just unfit for purpose. Instead, and I can only take from my professional and personal experiences, school staff almost seem to defend how amazing their schools are, even if children's needs aren't met, which can of course cause friction between staff and parents, quite rightly so. In my own personal case, there's no reason at all why staff can't agree that my Harry needs ARFID interventions, that his current needs cannot be met currently, and they could even apologise that there's no funding for that and agree at how frustrating that must be for me. At least then together we could have a conversation about how we then get funding to meet his need. This seems like a more logical and child-centred approach to working with children and families. However, perhaps the reason is that this might then bite them in the butt with Ofsted or the local authorities. Instead, they take the approach of keep telling me that he's eating his lunch when everyone sat at the table fully knows that he's not. And everyone looks very awkward indeed at these meetings because of this. So, although schools are shouting and advocating for more support to help with these needs, I do think improvements could be made on working alongside parents more realistically. Schools would likely love less children in each class, more teaching assistants in each class, and a full-time forest school running on the grounds, but they do not have the capacity and staff, the training, or the funding to run it. Also, the level of need is so high in mainstream schools that if interventions are put in place, the amount of children requiring interventions is absolutely huge. And suddenly you'll find that children are in interventions all day rather than education. And of course, schools are designed for education, and so you can see the issue they may face, particularly with Ofsted. As we know, Ofsted are primarily on site to assess education gains, SATs results, and safeguarding, very little to do with neurodiversity. The training on neurodiversity within schools is not as high as the safeguard training. And that kind of says it all. And that tends to be why everything ends up falling under safeguarding or parenting whenever concerns arise. I personally worry that neurodiversity training is limited in the amount of training staff can access, but also limited in the contents. Sometimes we can come across staff that have direct experience with neurodiversity within maybe their personal lives, and therefore they can prove really helpful. But if staff are only accessing training that the local authority are putting on, then I can feel that this really shows within the staff's understanding, suggestions, and therefore support. Masking is not well enough understood. Staff are not well enough trained in sleep disorders and eating disorders and masking within neurodiverse children. And my opinion only is there is a big gap in phonics understanding and dyslexia test understandings in order to really help children with neurodiversity. However, with that being said, that's not the staff members' fault. It's not their fault they can't access other training. It's the government's choice for funding and the local authority's choice as to how best to use it, and most will go on safeguarding. This means it's very unlikely if your child has complex needs that you will gain the understanding you would from, say, a CAMHS family support worker or a psychologist or a charity worker from Young Minds, for example, who are all highly trained in neurodiversity and the side effects from these disabilities. This, I feel, is the biggest barrier for neurodiverse children having a space, the understanding of what it is they are experiencing. Do you know, with regards to Harry, there is not one professional in Harry's mainstream school that even knows what ARFID is, let alone understand it from his perspective. Apparently, the Hampshire local authority put on a half-day course once a year in September on ARFID for professionals to attend. And this goes out to all professionals, police, social workers, teachers, everybody. This course is 3 hours long and covers only the textbook version of what ARFID is. Harry's been in school for 4 years, and still, the schools haven't allocated funding to send a member of staff on this training so that Harry can be well understood or supported. Although I don't agree, I can understand why funding is limited. Money from a school's perspective would likely be spent on, say, dyslexia training in comparison, over and above ARFID training, because there's more children with dyslexia, and therefore that money could be shown to benefit more pupils within the school. It's not okay, but when the funding is as tight as it is, I can see why the decision may be made. There is not enough funding to create safe spaces for neurodiverse children because the training in neurodiversity shouldn't just be in autism, ADHD, and PDA, but in the associated conditions such as ARFID, masking, eating disorders, low self-confidence, perfectionism, social disorders, difficulty in play, anxiety, autism burnout, skin and hair picking, girls and body image, social communication, fears, phobias, OCDs, sleep disorders, PDA, emotional dysregulation, equality and justice sensitivity. I could go on. Training in these areas would be far better than learning about eye contact and autism, or fidgeting and ADHD, or control and PDA. Because training in these areas, staff can now understand a family and the complexities of what they're facing. Let's have a look at some of the different staff roles and what they're facing within a mainstream environment. Again, this is a really short summary and by no means personal to any one particular member of staff. There are some wonderful school staff out there, even amongst the constraints of funding and policy. But let's start with attendance officers in schools. I used to be an attendance officer. Shh, don't tell anyone. For reference, my children had the worst attendance statistics due to mental health. An attendance officer's job is to get your child into school. They have gone on training about safeguarding and gone on training about missing children from education and how missing children from education have worst outcomes in the future. That was me. Their job success and whether they get to keep their job is measured on the attendance statistics improving. The school gets funding for that staff member to improve the attendance statistics. This job holds no neurodiversity training at all. And this member of staff will rarely liaise with the Senko because trying to pin down the Senko is something incredibly rare within a school. And so, if you try and have a conversation with an attendance officer about, say, child self-harm, burnout, anxiety, the best they can do is likely refer it to another member of staff. But their main aim will still be to get your child to school. You may get lucky and have someone discuss the option of a reduced timetable for your child, primarily, of course, but with attending full-time likely within 6 weeks. Because that's their job to get your child back into school full time. I do a separate podcast on EBSA, emotional based school avoidance. So if you wish to know more on how you should respond to poor interventions like the perhaps reduced timetable for 6 weeks only, then go over and check out this podcast. So, it's not likely that an attendance officer will have the capacity to be able to support you in the neurodiverse ways that you need. Now, that's no disrespect to the member of staff whatsoever. Like I say, I was an attendance officer, but they are educated and trained in attendance statistics and the impact on child well-being, not neurodiversity, anxiety, burnout, masking, and school difficulties. Let's have a look at the Senko. Everybody pins all their hopes on the Senko because the Senkos know everything, right? We wish. Wrong. The Senko is, however, the staff member who will likely understand a little better, but they're still constrained to funding time and policy. The Senko is responsible for approximately one in four children, and the Senko is only one person. Need I say any more? The bigger the school, the worse the service, and that's nothing personal because of the individual. That's just because there's too many children with need and only one Senko. Senko's roles are an awful lot of report writing. They facilitate all the referrals, the EHCPs, the reports. They have to record all the tests, the interventions, the nurture groups that your child may or may not have accessed. They have to obviously meet with children, families. Some children will not have their needs met because their job role is too big for one person. And that doesn't make the Senko very reachable or time available. That's when you try and plan a meeting, and it can take 6 weeks to book, which is a whole half term in a child's life. And then that meeting ends up being a 10-minute meeting before the end of the school day, and that's not likely going to prove helpful to you or your child. Again, neurodiversity requires space. Space requires time. Within that time, neurodiversity requires understanding, an understanding that comes from training. Currently, training that's either limited in availability or context, again, in my opinion. So let's talk teachers. Oh my goodness, they get the worst of it from us parents, don't they? Let's be real. They are the face we see and the face we complain to day in, day out. Teachers aren't trained in neurodiversity, although they are likely to be the most experienced with child behaviours. But with masking being so high and teachers needing to follow behaviour policies, it's unlikely to lead to like a connect before correct approach, especially with the stress of teaching targets set by Ofsted and school policy, and of course, 32 children per class. School staff are highly trained in safeguarding, but not neurodiversity. Neurodiverse children need a special kind of teacher, and they do exist. Harry has had the most amazing neurodiverse friendly teachers with incredible interventions such as touch therapy, and in some cases, he's had his own behaviour policy separate from other children. But because this is down to staff member, this soon changes when the new year changes and he has a new teacher. These neurodiverse friendly interventions are very much teacher dependent, which is highly frustrating for parents and carers of neurodiverse children. Personally, Harry went from having a great neurodiverse friendly teacher to a teacher who was then more concerned about behaviour and rules. This then, of course, affected his attendance and behaviour due to this change in approach and his needs not being met. And then, of course, unfortunately, this behaviour change then gets wrapped up in parental stigma and attendance fines and meetings rather than the accountability of staff training and experience in neurodiversity. Again, though, as frustrating as it is to say through gritted teeth sometimes, this isn't the staff's fault, particularly if they don't have personal experience with neurodiversity and they're just basing their teaching on their neurodiversity training from the local authority that may be unlikely to be suitable. That doesn't mean they mean any harm, it means they don't have the capacity to help. If we think about teachers for a moment, because they do seem to get the most criticism. They have classes of 32 children with likely no TA. They have likely a shared role. For example, there'll be a full-time teacher and head of year or and lead of English at the same time as being a teacher, which means they're not always in the classroom. Split roles is really common now, which, as a side note, is really unhelpful for neurodiverse children who, of course, need structure and routine. They have to be aware of all the service families. They have to be aware of all the neurospicy children, the families who are safeguarded, those that are academically behind age expected in academic areas, those that are ahead in academic areas, those whose parents have just split up, those who have family problems, those who may have lost a loved one, or who have siblings that may be in care. These are all just examples. On top of which, they likely have 2 to 4 bubbly children in the classroom, a bit like Harry, actually. This could mean children who are still waiting for a diagnosis for ADHD, but sometimes this can be behavioural. It's rare, but sometimes true. They have all of this while delivering school and Ofsted requirements of education and obtaining and marking academic gains that suit Ofsted and the school narrative. I am going to be completely honest with you. With all this going on, if I was a teacher, I'm not 100% that I could spot the child who was masking. That's not to say I would poo-poo it if you came with me with masking concerns, but realistically, what could I do about that in amongst my role as an expert in education? You see, government, due to not putting mental health specialists in schools full time and not overhauling the system, expect teachers to be psychologists, behaviour experts, but they're not. They're experts in education and safeguarding. That's the job requirement, and they are likely absolutely fantastic at it. But they're not experts in autism, ADHD, PDA, they're not psychologists or behaviour experts. And sometimes, as parents, of course, me too, when Harry's masking isn't properly understood, we expect teachers to be something they just don't have the capacity to do. I am so guilty of this. When teachers say, "It's tricky for us, we just don't see what it is you're explaining," I kind of get it because with everything they're having to do, these children go under the radar, particularly children who are masking or anxious, because the psychological knowledge isn't there in masking, in anxiety, in burnout, and the time just isn't there. For neurodiverse children to bond with a member of staff, they need time. And time is not what school staff have amongst teaching education, behaviour management, and of course, safeguarding. If this were me, if I was the teacher doing all of this role, how much time could I realistically give to each child in a class of 32? Likely not much. If you put that into minutes of an hour, you wouldn't even have the time to give them 2 minutes if you were to give each one individual time, and that would be without teaching any education. Neurodiverse children need time, and time isn't something that any member of staff in a school has. And I'm going to be completely real with you here. If I wouldn't be able to actually be a teacher, and I wouldn't want to be a teacher, I wouldn't cope under the pressures. And I know, even with all my neurodiversity knowledge, that I wouldn't do a very good job due to the time constraints and the expectations of a teacher. I would literally be fired in no time because I would prioritise mental health and time and spend time in the areas teachers can't, which means there would be no education. Children would be happy and healthy in my class, but they would be uneducated in what the curriculum considers important, and I would be fired. Does this mean school staff are bad people or against you? No, not at all. I know some amazing school staff. They too wish things could change and they could have a mental health lead in schools or two SENCOs or less children per class. It's not fair on them either, hence the high turnover of staff or stress among staff members. Let's look at the homeschool link worker or the family support worker. I was this role too within mainstream schools. I was both of these things. Homeschool link workers or family support workers don't always have neurodiverse training specifically. This is usually left to the SENCO. However, they may have training like I did in different interventions such as therapeutic story writing, Lego therapy, life story work, and they can run interventions with small groups of children and are responsible for many pockets of school life. And these pockets include, not limited to, but include service families that are in the Navy and the Army, safeguarding families, those that have social workers, children that are carers, children who are in foster care, children who've been touched by parent loss, children who've been touched by illness themselves or close family members, children with physical disabilities, children whose parents face addiction or prison sentences, children who have siblings with special needs. Children whose parents have separated, children who have social and communication difficulties. Again, I could go on. Neurodiversity isn't the only thing homeschool link workers and family support workers have to help. And again, there's usually only one per school, and they are running interventions for all of these children. The safeguarding children and those with safeguarding concerns will always come to the top of the priority list above all else on accessing any of these interventions. On the subject of interventions, the interventions that are run, for example, for children who are carers or service families, is because funding is given to the school deliberately by the local authorities to enable interventions for this particular group of children. And schools have to prove that they have spent the funding on what it was allocated for. So, although on the outside it can look like service families or safeguarded families get the better deal when it comes to interventions and support, it's not because of the school's choice, it's because the local authorities are in charge of that funding for that particular group, and the school actually has little control over this. Sometimes I hear parents complaining, and quite rightly so in some cases, that one child less in need receive more intervention than another child who's neurodiverse and clearly more in need. But parents don't always know if there are safeguarding or family problems associated with a particular child. Again, quite rightly so. So far, what does this mean? Well, if you found a school that supports you and teachers that have neurodiverse understanding, hold on to them tight. A supportive teacher in a supportive school will serve you better than an EHCP in some cases. If, however, you're gaining limited or no support or understanding, then realise it's not always the school's fault or the staff's fault personally within it. Going in and complaining to them personally isn't going to change these frustrations within the system. Changes that can be made are limited due to staff, funding, and policy. Being angry at a member of staff isn't going to change staff, funding, or policy. If you have a teacher who won't complete connect before correct approach with your child, the reaction shouldn't be that of anger, but actually that of understanding. Why won't they? Is it time? Is it funding? Or is it limited understanding of what my child needs? If it's any of those three things, it won't be the staff member's fault personally. They're not experts in neurodiversity or behaviour specialists. They are experts in education and safeguarding. We need behaviour specialists for sure, but then perhaps mainstream isn't then where our child should be. I hear some of you say, but my child isn't SEND enough for a SEND placement, same as my own children, so I feel the frustration. But this is where it feels that there's no space for neurodiverse children, either in time, training, funding, or understanding. The system is quite literally set to go against us. If the system was to overhaul schools, I think we could get some of our needs met for our children if class sizes drop down to 15 children per class, and that actually the members of staff at every single level were trained heavily in neurodiversity, but also the behaviours that run alongside neurodiversity, such as burnout, anxiety, such as masking, such as eating disorders, such as hair pulling, skin picking, social and communication difficulties. And if every single member of staff were trained alongside teaching training and alongside safeguarding in that way, I do believe that neurodiverse children's needs could be met much better. But what I'm asking for requires a whole system overhaul, which is an absolutely massive thing that likely won't be done in my children's lifetime. Let's move on to the local authority and EHCPs. They work through hundreds and hundreds of EHCP referrals. They also have funding and policy to work alongside. Now, that funding is not in their control, and I can assure you they likely wish things could change too. They do not know you or your family. The likelihood is that they have the same neurodiversity training, which I believe is limited in amount and content as what school staff are entitled to. And it depends upon how much funding departments have as to what training they allocate their staff to. Again, that's not in the staff's control. If you just think for a moment, hypothetically, about the way mainstream schools are set up right now, let's hypothetically believe that all EHCPs went through and all interventions were put in place, like one-to-ones, like weekly or daily small group interventions, occupational therapist and speech and language therapist visits and interventions. I can only wish. Let's say you didn't go to tribunal, they cut that out, it literally just got accepted. Every single EHCP got accepted. Think about the school structure that I've just spoken about. What would happen to it? It would literally crumble overnight because it doesn't have the staff, the training, the time, or the funding to be able to facilitate what the EHCPs are asking for. So, thinking logically about it, although I don't agree, yes, the local authority can only really put through the very high needs cases where perhaps SEND provisions would be required. It is a system not fit for purpose. It could be that the child needs educational psychologists, occupational therapists, speech and language interventions, and that these professionals come into school to deliver these interventions. But these interventions cost the mainstream schools money, and there is no money. I know we know that EHCP means more funding, but at a basic level, there is no funding to issue the EHCP in the first place. And the system wouldn't manage if they did all get put through. I will be doing a separate podcast on EHCP funding because you'll be surprised to learn that this doesn't quite work as we all expect that it does. So keep your eye out for that one. So, am I saying there's no point in applying for an EHCP? No, that's not what I'm saying. But please don't be shocked if it doesn't go through. Please expect that it will take 2 years to go through tribunal. And please don't be shocked if the interventions that actually get put into place within the EHCP, once it does go through, may not meet your expectations due to funding allocations. We should still apply for EHCPs, but we do need to manage our expectations of what we hope the outcome will be, considering the constraints of how the system is set up, like the ones I've already mentioned. For some children, EHCPs open doors that could not be opened before, so we can't run the risk of not getting one. But remember, the process isn't personal. Remember, the process is funding and policy led. Let's move on to Early Help Hub. Again, these are like family support workers, but at a local authority level rather than a mainstream school level. And again, we may need to manage our expectations. Just like in all professions, some members of staff are absolutely fantastic in understanding neurodiversity, and others sit within a more mainstream framework with their beliefs and their training. Early Help Hub professionals can't navigate the broken system any better than you can because that's out of their control, but they can help with parenting support. But for a lot of people, myself in here too, it can feel more like an unhelpful hindrance rather than help because we need to talk about topics that are relevant to neurodiversity. We need to talk about topics such as autism burnout, child self-harm, low self-esteem, chronic child anxiety, school trauma, eating disorders, emotional dysregulation. Really, we need CAMHS mental health protect practitioners, and we need someone who has extensive experience and training. The two are very different in this case, within these areas. Early Help Hub practitioners receive the same training put on by the local authority as what school staff, police, social workers all get. And it is the department responsibility to allocate funding towards certain training after safeguarding training. Again, this is not in the professional's control. I've had three Early Help Hub members support my family. It was incredibly unsuccessful in the way that none of them knew about a PDA approach or even very much about PDA. PDA training doesn't seem to make it to support staff roles, which in my case, didn't feel very supportive and certainly wasn't helpful. Let's move to NHS staff. Now, they are trained in neurodiversity, however, not in length unless they go into the mental health field. What holds NHS and doctors back is not the lack of compassion, empathy, or understanding, it's lack of time. Time spent with neurodiverse children in order to get them to take medicines, take off plasters, move from one room to the next needs to be increased. And unfortunately, staff are running around in hospitals like headless chickens. In emergency departments, this isn't their fault, this is the fault of funding. I've been in the emergency departments a few times with my neurodiverse children, and the standard of understanding that we have received is absolutely appalling. For both my children, they have had occurrences whereby the visit to the doctors in the hospital has been traumatic for them, which further aspirates their anxiety for the next time and then makes the next time even worse. But of course, as we know, time is money. But our neurodiverse children need time with practitioners, with doctors, with nurses in order to feel seen, heard, and understood. There needs to be enough time for empathy and compassion to come through, which builds a connection between one person and another. With that connection can then come trust, important trust for our children. But unfortunately, this can't always happen. Social workers are highly trained in safeguarding and crime rather than neurodiversity. And again, this training is put on by local authorities, budgeted by their yearly budgets. What this can do is lead to some opinions from very high up professionals that can perhaps not be as educated in neurodiversity as yourself, and this can hinder the support process. I'll tell you a very short story. My friend recently had a social worker visit her house for support with her neurodiverse child with very high up needs, so it is very clearly seen. And my friend could see that her child was heightening and getting more and more hyped because there was a social worker within the house, a new person. So, in order to bring her child down, she gave him an ice pop because the sensory aspect of freezing ice lolly helps to level him out. So, doing this, he stayed at a normal level of hyper, I guess, rather than going far too high. Now, rather than the social worker understanding sensory processing disorder and understanding the child as a whole person and what his behaviors are usually like, and therefore why mum did what she did, the social worker actually blamed mum for giving him an ice lolly and said the hyper was probably due to the E numbers in the ice lolly. Now, this uneducated opinion is because the social worker doesn't have time, because time is money, to really know and understand a family or a child, particularly a neurodiverse family. A neurodiverse family has so many complexities. So much more time is needed from social workers, with all staff really, but particularly social workers, in order to fully understand a family and their needs. For any child to open up to a new adult, this is going to take time, and for a neurodiverse child, even longer. A social worker has incredibly limited time. In fact, I'm going to say they're the worst. And so no relationship building is possible. Therefore, opinions will likely be based on an uneducated neurodiversity knowledge and always fall on the side of parenting and safeguarding, something that they're heavily trained in. Now, this is no fault of their own. Social workers work incredibly hard against their funding restrictions. They too would likely make to allocate more time to each family so that they can make a bigger difference. I really wish that when I worked within support services, but it's just not possible. Now, of course, if their training is heavily focused on safeguarding and parenting and not in neurodiversity, then they're likely going to see each and every complex issue fall under safeguarding or parenting issues rather than neurodiverse issues. As you can see, from any supportive level, from schools, local authority, early help hub, or social services, there isn't really lots of capacity for support or understanding. As parents and carers, we're all praying for that member of staff, that support worker, that teacher, that SENCO, that social worker, that nurse or doctor that has extensive experience and training in neurodiversity to get that slightly better understanding and service. Yet seemingly, there is just not enough of those special people to go around to all of our beautiful families, which is creating a big problem in accessing support and services. We do have to bear in mind that we have to think about our expectations. We have to remember that when we're sat at a table with mainstream staff about our child's complex needs, unless there are staff at that table from CAMHS, CENDIAS, or a children's charity such as Young Minds, we may likely find that our expectations of understanding and support not to be met due to the structures of the system, rather than the individuals themselves. We have to remember that if we are spoken to discriminatory or in a less than supportive way, it's likely down to an uneducated and inexperienced opinion on neurodiversity rather than a horrible person who dislikes you or your family personally. Believe me when I say staff are just as frustrated with the system and funding as what parents are. The setup of the system at each level goes to show the lack of capacity the system has when it comes to our neurospicy children. And that's why fighting the fight talk can feel so unhelpful to meeting children's needs, because we're fighting against a system that isn't set for neurodiverse children. It's a lengthy process. Therefore, calmly advocating our children's needs needs to become a way of life. A necessary one, but hopefully a journey that doesn't forever impact a family with stress, anxiety, depression, and illnesses that are irreversible. The message here is that the system as a whole, not the professionals in it, is in need of an absolute overhaul. If there is one professional that seems to be particularly unhelpful and discriminative or issues lots of parental blame instead of support, I can guarantee if you looked at their neurodiverse experience or training they have encountered, it would likely show you why they are that way. They are working within a very unfit for purpose, outdated system and are working against the tides of policies, structure, and funding. I can hear you. Okay. So we're hearing that it's not professional fault and it's higher than that. But what do? We can't ignore our child's needs and stop advocating altogether. You're right. No, we can't stop. We advocate constantly for our children's needs, but actually having the knowledge of how the system works may adjust our expectation in the staff and systems within it so that we can empower ourselves to make positive decisions rather than keep fighting against or waiting for a broken system to change. Knowledge in this case is power, and in this case, this certainly helps us consider how best to achieve our outcomes for our children. Understanding the system can help us adjust our expectations, which may open doors for us to better make decisions moving forwards. Many people ask me with my own children, how do you navigate such a broken system? I'll share with you. My plan with my own children in mind is to move through the system, constantly advocating for my children's needs, applying for the EHCPs and interventions as they need them, but without engaging too much with uneducated and inexperienced staff at any level within the field of neurodiversity, because this is where safeguarding parental blame and discrimination come into play, which can cause trauma for myself and my family. That is my boundary. If this does happen, of course, this trauma to myself and my family, I will, of course, write complaint letters. But the fight is not the biggest thing. My children's needs are. If mainstream can't meet them, I will. I attempt to quietly move through protecting myself against the system that's unfit for purpose and to meet my children's needs. Just like every other parent and carer of a neurodiverse child, I move through the mainstream system praying for that member of staff that understands neurodiversity in a system where there isn't enough of these special people. I don't want a social worker or an early help hub worker because, quite frankly, I don't have the time amongst my caring responsibilities to explain to somebody else what avoidance and restrictive food intake disorder is. And how masking and anxiety affects my neurodiverse child, when in return, I don't get the level of support that I know I require. That means I'm not fighting for support in these places, because what I'm fighting for doesn't exist in these places. The kind of support that I require exists from a CAMHS level. I will empower myself to advocate for my children's needs while engaging with only the professionals that matter for my family, such as educational psychologists, speech and language, CAMHS professionals, charity professionals. And I adapt my expectations based on my knowledge of the system so that I'm not constantly fighting for something that may actually only cause stress, trauma, and anxiety to myself and my children. I stopped waiting for a broken system to apologize, recognize, or change. And I empowered myself to handle whatever comes my way. If you too would like to know how you can achieve this, there are some empowering things that you can do right now, today, for you and your family in order to take back control and stop waiting for a broken system to change or be victim to a mainstream system that causes nothing but trauma in some cases. If you'd like more information on how you too can empower yourself, do go over to the podcast named Protect Yourself from Mainstream Trauma. So, how should you navigate this system that seems to have little space for neurodiversity? Well, it's about leaning into the complexities of the system and figuring out how best to work alongside a broken, unfit for purpose system that best suits your family, but that also reduces and protects you from stress and trauma along with its side effects. This can mean changing your own expectations so that the fight that you're having doesn't only have the outcome of stress and burnout on you as the parent or caregiver, but that the fight or advocating your child's needs does actually have the ability to meet your child's needs. Knowing what you are fighting for is actually possible for whom you are asking. That's really important. This is exactly how understanding the system a little bit better may help you change your mindset. but perhaps also restructure how you approach advocating for your child's needs, which could in fact empower you in reducing stress, burnout, and trauma while advocating for your child's neurodiverse support needs. If you haven't yet, do go over and listen to the podcast about mainstream trauma and how we can protect ourselves against it, but also how we can empower ourselves when we do engage with a system that's unfit for purpose. I do hope that this podcast leaves you feeling that knowledge is power, and that actually, in order to win against this broken system, means taking back some control, adjusting our expectations, and empowering ourselves. As always, be kind to you today. And I look forward to seeing you next time. Now for the boring but important disclaimer. Please remember that this podcast is for education and entertainment purposes only and does not take the place of advice sought from a trained psychologist or therapist. Thank you.